The next case on the docket is People v. Jones, case number 2011-SC-801. Case is set for half an hour, 15 minutes per side. The court is ready. Thank you. A couple of quick housekeeping matters. Petitioner and people in this case will have to keep track of your time. And secondly, when you do argue, please tell us who you are and who you represent. And lastly, I want everybody to know that we use iPads. And we have our briefs on the iPads, and we have our notes, so we're not surfing and sending emails. We're paying attention to that. For that, we're ready to proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Will Kozlowski. Will Kozlowski, registration number 37824, on behalf of the people. This case presents the question of whether evidence of defendant's previous two sexual assaults of similar women under similar circumstances satisfies the four-part test of the People v. Spoda. There is no dispute that the first prong is satisfied. Contrary to the Court of Appeals' conclusion, the District Court did not abuse its discretion in concluding that the other three prongs were satisfied as well. Under this Court's precedence in the rules of evidence, the admissibility of other acts does not depend on whether they meet the strictures of certain narrow categories. Rather, evidence is admissible if it meets three requirements. First, it must be logically relevant. Second, it must not be offered for the purpose of proving conformity with bad character. And finally, the evidence must be legally relevant. That is, its probative value must not be substantially outweighed by the danger of unfair prejudice. This court should reverse because the trial court acted within its discretion when it concluded that each of these requirements was satisfied. As to the first, the evidence was logically relevant. This requirement is satisfied if the evidence has any tendency at all to make a material fact more or less probable. Here, the prosecution sought to introduce evidence that the defendant had sexually assaulted two other blonde, white, intoxicated, isolated women, one in Miami and one in New Orleans. The trial court concluded that this evidence was logically relevant to prove the defendant's common plan, scheme, or design and to refute consent. This conclusion was not unreasonable. The evidence made it more probable that the defendant had a preconceived plan and method of committing sexual assault. In turn, that method made it more likely that defendant intended to have sex with the victim regardless of her consent, that he intended to use force. It made it more likely that the sex act occurred in this case, and it explained why he selected the victim. In other words, all of the victim's race, hair color, intoxication level, and isolation were probative facts of the defendant's plan and method. As to the second requirement, the inferences that I just discussed do not depend on the defendant's character. In other words, other acts can show a criminal plan or design without depending on any inference of criminal character. Defendant sexually assaulted two similar women under similar circumstances, and that evidence was not offered to prove propensity or conformity with his character. Apart from any character inference, the commonalities demonstrate that defendant, as a factual matter, had a predetermined, preconceived design of how he was going to carry out a particular crime against a particular type of victim in a particular fashion. The common characteristics of the victims were not coincidental facts or were not coincidental happenings to a person of bad character. Rather, the shared characteristics evidence a pattern of behavior that demonstrated a method of committing crimes like the one the defendant was on trial for. Those inferences do not hinge on defendant's character.
Do you think that the Court of Appeals didn't need to get into the whole doctrine of chances at all?
No,
what's your opinion with respect to that?
I think it's sort of inexplicable why the Court of Appeals just went to doctrine of chances because it wasn't discussed in the briefs of the Court of Appeals. I think doctrine of chances inferences are, how should I say this, when when evidence shows a common plan as circumstantially shows a common plan, there generally are doctrine of chances inferences present that the jury could also draw, but those weren't the inferences that the prosecution was urging in this case. And it's our position that the Court of Appeals didn't even need to get there. And also contrary to the Court of Appeals' conclusion, a plan doesn't need to be novel in order for the evidence to be admissible. A defendant's plan is a defendant's plan. A novel plan only needs to be present when the prosecution is urging the jury to say, apart, without even looking at other evidence, you can look at these acts and conclude that defendant is the person who did it because it's a strange plan or an odd plan, or he does something strange during the crime that differentiates. We can say it's so unlikely that you are the person who did this crime.
Do I remember right from your briefs there was DNA evidence in this case for identification?
Yes, there was DNA evidence as to the charged crime and the prior crimes as well.
So I didn't go back and look at the record. Maybe you could remind me. So was the substantial disagreement in this case or the question of defense? It may have just been a general denial, but was the only thing at issue really a question of consent?
Yeah, the defendant endorsed general denial and consent, but essentially the trial was about, defendant essentially argued that the prosecution hadn't proved lack of consent for use of force. Okay. That was the question of trial. And as to that issue, this evidence was particularly probative, which leads me to the 403 analysis. The other acts provided a strong and apparent inference as to defendant's common plan. There was no question of what his intention was on each occasion. There were multiple assaults, which lessened any unfair prejudice to the defendant. And particularly in this case, the victim died. They matched defendant's DNA. He was charged and the victim died a few months later, and so she wasn't present for trial. So the necessity of the evidence, which is one of the concerns in the 403 balancing test, we couldn't prove lack of consent. We had her saying that she didn't consent, but that was it. And so this evidence was particularly probative on that issue.
Did the defendant testify, Mr. Kozolowski?
No, Chief Justice, he did not.
Was there any evidence presented by the defense?
I believe he recalled one of the detectives to bring out some prior inconsistent statements, but on the whole, he really didn't present any affirmative evidence of what occurred. And I'd like to turn to, We have a 404B, but we also, in sexual assault cases, we also have 1610.301, which, I think if you look at this case, this is precisely the type of case that the General Assembly intended to have evidence like this introduced. Here we have a woman who claims sexual assault, and the General Assembly has declared that people are hesitant to credit such an accusation, particularly because most of the time it's a he said, she said kind of situation. And the General Assembly has found that offenders commit multiple assaults over a long period of time through similar methods or common design. Thus, the legislature has recognized that evidence in cases such as this should be let in to aid the jury to decide factual issues. Not because the other evidence shows that the defendant is a bad person, but because it demonstrates to the jury as a logical matter that the victim was selected for the purpose of sexual assault because of her hair color, race, intoxication level, and particular vulnerability.
There was DNA evidence here that he committed these other two.
Yeah, there was DNA evidence on each case, the New Orleans case, the Miami case, and our case. That was kind of a...
Right.
They found in The Miami case was the last one that he was arrested on that.
And the defense point seems to be that this is really bad character evidence, that, you know, right?
I mean, certainly these other acts have a tendency to show that he's a bad person or he's a sexually violent person. But the question is there something more that you can conclude from this evidence? And it shows that he selects a particular type of victim with a cert who is visibly intoxicated at a particular time of day. And the inferences that you can draw from those facts have nothing to do with
it. Okay, the doctrine of chances has some kind of statistical basis to it. So how many times would he have to commit this before the Court of Appeals would be convinced?
I'm not sure, and I think the Court of Appeals was wrong in narrowing it down to say it has to be a particular crime to meet the doctrine of chances. I think a good way to show where the Court of Appeals erred is to use one of the common examples when people discuss the doctrine of chances is, say someone takes someone hunting and a bullet whizzes by their head, and then a month later he takes someone hunting and another bullet whizzes by his head, and he does it two or three times. The doctrine of chances says, what are the chances that a bullet whizzes by someone's head by accident? And you can just say, without reference to character, say it's just objectively improbable that that would happen. Well, that's true, but it also shows that the defendant has a plan to take people hunting and kill them. I mean, that is circumstantial evidence. It's two different inferences, and essentially the Court of Appeals said that the doctrine of chances is the test, but it's one way to satisfy the test.
Working off your hypothetical about the hunter situation or the lottery that was mentioned a couple of times in the briefs, is it your view that the doctrine of chances is grounded in the notion that something is an accident? I mean, it's just sort of a weird set of circumstances.
I think this court observed in Raffitt, you can use it for pretty much any circumstance. Another example is someone who has a daycare who has 15 children die by some unexplained.
And the theory there would be that all 15 deaths couldn't have all just been accidents. They were unusual circumstances.
Well, not just that they were accidents, but that they also don't happen without some affirmative act by someone. That there's probably something criminal at work there. It doesn't just happen by accident, but also that doesn't happen without someone making that happen.
Yeah, and the point of my question is simply to kind of suss out what is the underpinning of this doctrine, and therefore then how it applies in the 404B context. You mentioned in an identity situation where we're trying to find out whether this is a person committed this crime, and we don't have that concern here. It's not an identity issue in this case. Are there other examples that the doctrine of chances functions in the 440 context?
I mean, as I said, I think it's usually present. When you have circumstantial evidence to show common plan or MO, it's, and I think this case is a good example, that it's just objectively improbable that there would be multiple unfounded accusations of sexual assault, and that it's improbable that it would just happen, but it's also improbable that those things happen in the absence of design, which comes back to, it's our position that this evidence was admissible under both theories, but certainly our main contention at trial is that it was just circumstantial evidence of his plan to commit a particular crime.
Thank you.
And I'll reserve both the time.
Good morning, Nora Kelly here on behalf of the defendant, Mr. Jones. The facts in this case are unique in that the victim had died before trial. trial. And so the prosecution had a problem there, and the way that they solved it was to bring in these two other sexual assaults that Mr. Jones was alleged to have committed, and that was really the what the prosecution presented at trial, because there just wasn't enough with the alleged victim in Colorado Springs. As the Court of Appeals noted, most of the trial consisted of testimony from these other two alleged victims from Miami and New Orleans. And the Court of Appeals then was skeptical about this evidence being used to convict Mr. Jones. And in its analysis, in its opinion, went through in great detail and weighed the evidence and compared it to the evidence that was presented at the trial about the sexual assault in Colorado Springs, and came to the conclusion that really the evidence, this 404B evidence, was too far afield to be viewed as anything other than just to show that because these other two sexual assaults had occurred, that that means that the allegations that there was a sexual assault in Colorado Springs was true. And the petitioner in this case is critical about the Colorado Court of Appeals' use of the Doctrine of Chances, but it appears to me that actually what the petitioner is arguing is the Doctrine of Chances, that this was unique evidence and that it should have come in under that. And the Court of Appeals pretty much did a good job of saying that it just didn't work.
Ms. Keller, may I ask you a question? Because I was uncertain from reading the Court of Appeals' opinion, too, exactly with respect to that point. They seem to be suggesting, unless I'm misreading it, that the prosecution was, in fact, relying upon the Doctrine of Chances. And yet, opposing counsel seems to indicate, and I'm sure he's correct, that that never was brought up before the Court of Appeals, that that seems to be an issue that they injected. Can you tell me your perspective on that, please?
Well, it's true. In the brief that I filed with the Court of Appeals, I did not bring up the Doctrine of Chances. But that doesn't mean that the Court of Appeals couldn't, in parsing Spoto and all the elements that are necessary there, couldn't address the Doctrine of Chances. My perception is that the Court of Appeals was looking for something to justify the prosecution's bringing in all this evidence of these other two sexual assaults, and that the Doctrine of Chances would be applicable, but the prosecution just didn't meet the test.
Could I ask you a question also about the Doctrine of Chances? We were sort of all dancing around the question whether this was necessary at all and why the Court of Appeals lit on it. Do you see any reason why it is beneficial or worthwhile to rely on this sort of vague Doctrine of Chances? If we have good evidence that the defendant did commit the prior offenses, I guess what I'm asking is, does the Doctrine of Chances seem to be a doctrine that fills in the gap where all of looking at all of the crimes as a whole is necessary to show that the defendant committed any one of them? But if you have good evidence that he committed prior ones, then aren't we just more concerned with the degree of similarity or whatever the connection is to show that, to make it more likely that the missing element in the current case is also present? In this case, simply consent, right? And along with that,
May I ask, don't we usually say that uniqueness of the prior crimes is much less important if we're not trying to show identity? We're not trying to rule out other people as having committed this, and all we're trying to do is show whether it was a mistake or it was consensual or something like that. Could you address that generally?
And if you could clarify, I'm not clear about your last question about the identity question.
I guess where I was going with it is, why is the doctrine of chances important? Why is it important or necessary to bring in the concept of the doctrine of chances, where we have a case in which there seems to be very strong evidence of the prior crimes, and the current crime is not even, or the question is not even to prove that the defendant did it, but rather simply whether it was consensual or not?
Well, I don't think that the doctrine of chances just applies if there's a question of identity. I think it would apply in any 404B analysis, and that's what the Court of Appeals did. This evidence came in under 404B, and the Court of Appeals was trying to make sense of why this evidence came in and used the doctrine.
And I guess I didn't mean to be saying it wouldn't be applicable, but why is it helpful? Why does one need to turn to that? Does that sort of confuse the issue to turn toward a doctrine of chances? How do you see it being helpful to the analysis here?
Well, it's helpful because these were three sexual assaults that happened at different times in different places. And I believe what the Court of Appeals was doing was trying to find analyzing whether there was some common distinguishing marker to the three sexual assaults that would make them unique. And that's where the doctrine of chances comes in. That's my understanding. And I couldn't find that.
Isn't the Court of Appeals relying upon out-of-state cases for the most part and law review articles, that kind of thing, to almost incorporate this doctrine of chances method of analysis into pretty classic spot out of 404 type stuff?
And your question is, did it rely on out-of-state cases?
And law reviews. I guess he's not a law review so much as a treatise.
I believe it did, yes.
But we, the Supreme Court, we haven't held that way, have we?
I don't believe so. No, I think this is a...
So this is the Court of Appeals, in a way, inserting, at the very least, a method of analysis on a pretty standard 404 analysis that's been around, 30 years since Spada. I don't know when Spada was, but long time ago.
Well, the court was... going into detail, yes, to those Spado factors, trying to find how this evidence would come in under 404B. I don't have anything else to add. I'll just stand on my briefs unless there are any other questions.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Rebuttal.
Opposing counsel says that we're arguing that the previous sexual, because this previous sexual assault occurred, that the sexual assault occurred here. So that statement just begs the question. We're saying that these previous sexual assaults occurred, and it's why are we arguing that it occurred here? It's because he has a particular method of selecting a particular victim in a particular situation for a particular type of crime.
What's in the Court of Appeals was very critical about 2 days of trial being dedicated to these other incidents. What's your comment on that kind of analysis?
I think you have to identify a concern in and of itself that I don't think that means anything. If if the evidence was admissible, if it satisfies the second and third prong, I think that that may come in the fourth prong of whether most of the trial is going to be about this. But if the evidence is particularly probative of disputed issues, then there's nothing wrong with spending 2 days of trial on that subject. And as to your question, Justice Coates, I think the Court of Appeals is confused about what the doctrine of chances is, and I agree with you, Justice Rice, that they seem to be injecting it into cases where there's where Spoto is the analysis. And I think Heron is the best example of that. There was a and that was a case in our favor. They identified inferences about the defendant's knowledge, his subjective knowledge, and then they said that's independent of character because it's the doctrine of chances. And knowledge has nothing to do with the doctrine of chances. And I see my time is up. We ask that you reverse the Court of Appeals. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I thank both parties for your arguments and the briefs. The case is submitted on the briefs.